host in the Lowy Lecture Series here at the National Press Club. I'm Sam Roggeveen, Director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and paying our respect to the elders past, present and emerging. Thank you all for being here, ladies and gentlemen. I want to acknowledge also Alan Gingell, the founding executive director of the Lowy Institute. Alan, thanks so much for being here. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lowy Institute's been an active, I think vigorous, I can say, participant in Australia's rapidly growing national debate about China and the implications of its rise for our region, for our alliance, for our economy, for our defence. But China's rise also has important implications for our democracy. And here, the national debate could do with some reinforcement. It's true there's been no shortage of discussion about foreign interference and a vigorous policy response too from the Turnbull government in 2018, which was supported by the Labor opposition. But I'm making a slightly different point. In my observation, at least, Australian political commentary tends to treat our politics as a closed system. In the news and the opinion we consume daily about events just up on the hill, we're rarely offered international context. For instance, Australia suffered a decade-long rolling leadership crisis within both its two major parties, and also a still unresolved policy deadlock on climate change. Yet the reasons for these failures are almost always assumed to come from within. Rarely do our public commentators step back to look at global trends. Rarely do they consider whether Australia is being buffeted by the same forces shaking American democracy and European nations. Equally, I think, our foreign policy boffins could stand to pay a bit more attention to Australian domestic politics. They've done very well, I think, to alert Australia to the scale of the China challenge. But they assume, I think, that that challenge will be met by a political system and by a party political settlement, if I can call it that, that's basically stable. I think that's a brave assumption. What we have in prospect this evening, ladies and gentlemen, is a welcome break from that pattern. Our speaker today is one of the Federal Labor Party's brightest minds. Tim Watts argues that the Liberal Democratic model faces its biggest challenge in generations. Since the global financial crisis, democratic systems have faced a crisis of public confidence, and open economies have struggled to deliver the broad-based growth of the past. And at the same time, in a number of nations around the world, an alternative model of techno-authoritarianism has emerged, in which mass surveillance and artificial intelligence are being used to build systems of social control. In a moment, Tim Watts MP will discuss the ways these competing models of organising society are challenging the health of our democratic institutions, political parties, parliaments and the media. That will be followed by a Q&A session with me and, of course, with all of you. It only remains for me to introduce Tim Watts MP, who was elected to the Parliament in 2013 as the Labor member for Gellibrand. He's the Shadow Assistant Minister for Communications and Cybersecurity and a member of the Joint Standing Committee on the National Broadband Network. He was formerly an executive in the telecom sector and prior to that, a solicitor and senior political advisor. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tim Watts.
Thank you, Sam, for that very generous introduction. And thank you to the Lowy Institute for hosting me here tonight. I too would like to acknowledge Alan, a doyen of Australian foreign policy who continues to contribute to the development of policymaking in Australia. I'm a bit of a geek, unashamedly so. I've worked in the technology sector for about 10 years before I got into Parliament. So I've got my dream job now, working as a Shadow Assistant Minister for Cybersecurity. And working in cybersecurity today can sometimes feel a bit like you've been stationed in East Berlin during the Cold War. In recent years, we've seen state-sponsored hacking groups with exotic names like Cozy Bear, Sandworm, and the Lazarus Group successfully hack multinational banks, presidential campaigns, and power grids. We've seen an entity known as Phineas Fisher hacking Cayman Island banks and then using the proceeds to set up a hacktivist bug hunting program, a bounty for public interest hacks targeting companies working in surveillance, technology, mining, and resources. We've seen very well-resourced international crime syndicates mount a wave of ransomware attacks, hacks that seize control of an organisation's IT systems until a Bitcoin ransom is paid, against more than 1,000 schools, hospitals and local governments in the US alone, causing worldwide losses of over $1 billion in 2019. So there's a bit going on. But I find that I spend most of my time in this portfolio wondering less about the dramatic and more about pondering an earnest question, the health of Australian democracy. This is a bit of a new thing for people of my generation. My earliest political memory was the fall of the Berlin Wall. I was in grade 2. Sorry about that, Alan. I can remember sitting cross-legged in a classroom while our teacher showed us the tape of a television news broadcast of people tearing down the wall. I understood something important was going on, but I had no idea what it really meant. People of my generation, Gen Y, grew up in the most benign international security and economic environment in Australia's history. A generation of peace and growth. A world in which US hegemony within a rules-based international order was the default. A world in which the internet proliferated in accordance with the norms of Western societies and economies, open and free from centralised government control. A world which prompted the political scientist Francis Fukuyama to famously declare the end of history. After September 11, 2001, our complacency was challenged by the growing threat of Islamic extremist terrorism in the West, but even this threat was a challenge to our physical security, not our democratic system. Today, though, the liberal democratic model itself faces its biggest challenge in generations. Since the global financial crisis, democratic systems have faced a crisis of public confidence, and open economies have struggled to deliver the broad-based growth of the past. Significant minorities across the West simply do not believe that democracy is delivering for them, and as a result, trust in our democratic institutions is collapsing. At the same time, in several nations around the world, an alternative model of techno-authoritarianism has emerged, in which new tools of mass surveillance and artificial intelligence are being used to build systems of social control. These technology-enabled autocracies often states founded on Marxist principles of information control, where censorship and propaganda have long been core priorities of government. This isn't like the Cold War, though. These techno-authoritarian states are not trying to impose their system onto others. However, we have seen some authoritarian states use their model of information control to pursue national objectives via the open internet of Western democracies. For the first time in a generation, democracies are facing external threats to their sovereignty in the form of cyber-enabled disinformation campaigns and potentially externally controlled censorship of widely used platforms used for political communication within our own borders. Whether we can meet this challenge will depend on the resilience of our democratic institutions. And in this respect, we have a lot of work to do. The most recent Australian election study from the ANU shows that faith in our political system has seriously deteriorated since the global financial crisis. Indeed, the study finds that just 1 in 4 Australians has any faith in their political leaders or institutions. Just 59% are satisfied with how democracy is working, a collapse of 27% since 2007. In Australia, faith in democracy is in free fall. Professor Ian McAllister, who led the study, said, "I've been studying elections for 40 years and never have I seen such poor returns for public trust in and satisfaction with democratic institutions." Most disturbing are the findings of the Lowy poll, that less than 2/3 of Australians believe that democracy is preferable to any other kind of government. That 1 in 5 Australians, and importantly 1 in 3 Australians aged under 30, believe that in some circumstances a non-democratic government can be preferable. The causes of this loss of public trust and legitimacy are complex. In my view, one reason is that politics has been unable to deliver on the things that really matter to people, like climate change, secure work and housing. But it's important to appreciate that it's not just our political institutions that are weakened. We've seen a collapse in public trust in nearly every institution in our democracy. The institution that has experienced the greatest change has been our media. The proliferation of the internet has radically transformed the Australian media system, our information system. According to the Australian Election Study, between the 1969 and 2019 elections, the proportion of Australians who followed the campaign via the television news fell from 60% to 22%. For newspapers, the fall was even greater, from 55% to 11%. The driver of this change in media consumption obviously has something to do with the internet. But the internet hasn't merely changed the medium that people use to consume the media. It's radically changed the entire media system. At its most fundamental level, the internet collapses transaction costs. The transaction costs are the costs of finding people with shared interests and then working out a way to communicate and trust them so that you can work together. 20 years ago, if I wanted to buy a car, I might incur the transaction costs of buying a newspaper, and then flicking through the classified section to find a seller before picking up the phone and making an offer. The transaction costs of buyers and sellers finding each other underpinned the rivers of gold that cross-subsidised an independent advertising-funded journalism for nearly a century. That business model is now gone. Disintermediated by internet platforms like carsales.com and domain.com that allow buyers and sellers to find each other directly and efficiently. In its place is a model in which media outlets try to stay afloat by subscriptions and targeted advertising. The editorial incentives of this model are different. Instead of seeking to appeal to a broad base of readers and classified bargain hunters, media outlets increasingly seek to serve political tribes. What drives clicks and subscriptions among these tribes are culture wars, not public interest journalism. The media still does incredibly valuable public interest journalism, to be sure, but it's not usually what makes them money. In this respect, social media is even worse. The collapse of transaction costs on social media platforms has allowed people to build communities of interest around every imaginable niche. In an age of social media, of course, it takes just seconds to find a group of others who share your interests. The problem is these groups are frequently comprised people who share and reinforce our biases. The proliferation of Facebook groups and subreddits for ultra niche groups in this new media environment might be mostly harmless, but for groups of anti-vaxxers, white supremacists and QAnon aficionados, they can cause real harm. These problems are even more acute when these platforms enable targeted advertising to amplify messages to segments of our community that may be vulnerable to particular messaging. All of this has left us with a hackable media system, a media system that can't help itself from being hijacked by confected conflict and division. This new media system is not serving our politics well. Extremism and misinformation flourishes in this new environment. A series of misinformation outbreaks, often about issues where the reliability of information is paramount, underlies the costs of this new environment. This summer, we've seen misinformation and disinformation about the bushfires, the novel coronavirus, and so much so that the World Health Organization has referred to it as an infodemic. There's been a lot of attention about how domestic populists have exploited this new media environment around the world, but it's also been exploited by foreign actors seeking to subvert our sovereignty. While democracies around the world have been ailing for a decade, we've also seen an alternative model emerging. It's been another rude awakening for the West. Like Fukuyama, the tech utopians who believed in the internet as a liberating technology have been badly shown up. In the year 2000, US President Bill Clinton welcomed a trade deal with China by declaring, "In the new century, liberty will be spread by cell phone and cable modem. We know how much the internet has changed America, and we are already an open society. Imagine how much it can change China." Clinton understood that this change would be resisted, but he was unconcerned, literally laughingly telling Chinese censors, "Good luck," and declaring that attempts to regulate the internet were sort of like trying to nail jello to the wall. In the knowledge economy, economic innovation and political empowerment, whether anyone likes it or not, will inevitably go hand in hand. But that's not what's happened. For decades now, states like Russia and later China have been arguing in multilateral international forums that the internet ought to be governed according to the norms of what they describe as cyber sovereignty, a vision of an internet that is centrally controlled by national governments which strictly manage information flows on it. In recent times, they have effectively implemented this within their borders. In the 1990s, an individual's experience of the internet was similar, regardless of where they logged on. Today, it's radically different, depending on where you're using it. In recent years, authoritarian governments have used data localization requirements, VPN crackdowns, and coercive powers over internet platforms to effectively nail jello to the wall. China imposes pervasive restrictions upon the online content its citizens can access and what they themselves are permitted to share. A parallel ecosystems of websites and apps have evolved to comply with these restrictive rules and to serve domestic markets. Russia and Iran are both advanced in creating their own enclosed internet. Both countries are developing and testing the ability to effectively cut their citizens off from the global internet altogether, creating instead a claustrophobic ecosystem of state-approved material while also making it much easier to monitor their citizens. A recent article in Foreign Affairs three scholars shared their analysis of so-called digital dictatorships. Not only did they find that autocracies are more likely to be strengthened than undermined by technology, but they also found that not only has the rising tide of technology seemingly benefited all dictatorships, but our own empirical analysis shows that those authoritarian regimes that rely more heavily on digital repression are among the most durable. Now, even more unexpectedly than this, not only has the internet failed at exporting freedom within authoritarian nations, in recent times, it has begun exporting authoritarian propaganda and censorship into liberal democracies. Cyber-enabled information operations and disinformation campaigns are now common in Western countries. According to research undertaken by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, since the 2016 US presidential election, 20 nations have experienced cyber-enabled foreign interference. Coordinated inauthentic behaviour, the torturous neologism for distributed information operations on social media platforms, is now a jarring part of both the technology and foreign policy lexicons. We've seen online information operations on issues as diverse as the Hong Kong protests, West Papua, and the alleged health impacts of the 5G network rollout. And in countries as diverse as Australia, Libya, France, and the Central African Republic. Sometimes there are specific objectives to these campaigns, discrediting an opponent, helping a candidate win an election, or changing a government's position. Sometimes the objective is simply to inflame division, disrupting the ability of democratic systems to build sufficient consensus for action. Regardless of their objective, the success or failure of these campaigns is dependent on the health of the democratic institutions of the target state. The prevalence and scale of these campaigns is simply too much for any central government security agency alone to handle. If we imagine disinformation as a virus that can harmfully spread through a social body, then our immune system is the institutions that can quickly and credibly identify it and counter it: a free media, civil society, and our parliaments. The effectiveness of these institutions in this task is dependent on the public's trust in them. In this way, ensuring the health of our democratic institutions is a national security imperative. While in the past, national security debates, some have seen a trade-off between individual liberties and national security, today they are indisputably intrinsically linked. To understand the importance of public confidence in our democratic institutions in responding to disinformation campaigns, we need only look at the far greater problems that authoritarian nations have with managing misinformation within their own information systems. Without a free press and absent independent checks and balances on government, people in authoritarian nations know that they can't trust what their leaders and public authorities tell them. In Russia, ubiquitous censorship and state propaganda has led to an information system in which Peter Pomerantsev, the Russian-born British journalist, has famously observed that nothing is true and everything is possible. As a result, cults, faith healers, pyramid schemes, and conspiracy theories are mainstream national preoccupations in Russia. Extraordinarily, nearly 6 in 10 Russians believe that the Apollo moon landings were a hoax. In China, government authorities and state media compete with a constantly churning rumour mill as state pronouncements are second-guessed and members of the public seek to triangulate the truth from as many sources of information as possible, no matter how dubious. What this underlines is that our ability to respond to disinformation relies on public trust in our institutions. Technology won't solve this for us. Public trust in our institutions should be the comparative advantage of liberal democracy over authoritarian states in a new information environment. Unfortunately, decades of complacency about the state of our democracy has left these institutions seriously weakened. The absence of a serious alternative to democracy since the end of the Cold War has allowed us to take democracy for granted. We've neglected it. Renewing our democracy is a challenge for everyone in our nation, regardless of ideology. The Catholic conservative, G.K. Chesterton, recognised the conservative value in renewal or refreshing. He wrote that all conservatism is based on the idea that if you leave things alone, you leave them as they are, but you do not. If you leave a thing alone, you leave it to a torrent of change. If you leave a white post alone, it will soon be a black post. If you particularly want it to be white, you must always be painting it again. The white post of Australian democracy is rapidly turning black in the face of of a torrent of technological and social change. Turning this around will require both advocacy and reform. Our generation of political leaders face the same challenge that leaders like John Curtin, JFK and Ronald Reagan did in the past, winning the hearts and minds of the public for the cause of democracy. We need to ask ourselves how we want our democracy to work in the face of this technological change. How do we think about the relationship between citizens, the state, and internet platforms? How can we grow and maintain the shared space, the mutual regard, and the common interests that we need for our democracy to function? Are our actions at home, the norms we follow and the laws we pass, consistent with the norms of a free, open, and secure internet that we advocate for in international fora? What do we need to do to restore public trust in our democratic institutions? An important forum in which these questions will be asked over the coming years is the Select Committee on Foreign Interference Through Social Media, chaired by Senator Jenny McAllister. This inquiry was established in December last year and is not due to report until May 2022. The committee will look at the use of social media to spread fake news, stoke civil divisions and undermine elections, and will ultimately make recommendations about mitigating the risk of hostile actors exploiting social media to subvert our democracy. Given the length of time this inquiry will run, though, we expect that one of the most important roles that this committee will play is in educating the public about and their political representatives and the media that covers it about these issues. There are a few issues that I think are worth particular consideration in this inquiry. Alex Stamos, the director of the Stanford Internet Observatory and the former head of security of Facebook and before that Yahoo, has recently called for the limitation of micro-targeting of political advertising to extremely granular segments of the population on social media. Think of literally tens of thousands of automatically iterating ads finely targeted to exploit the specific biases and vulnerabilities of small groups of people. Another issue that will attract attention in this inquiry is whether social media platforms, Stamos has pointed out not only how this is allowing political actors to be different things to different segments of the population, but also how much harder this at-scale segmentation makes the task of calling out misinformation and lies. It's one thing to call out one lie, it's another thing to call out 10,000. Another issue that will attract attention in this inquiry is whether social media platforms owned by companies based in authoritarian states raise special concerns for our democracy. Should we be concerned about the potential for state-directed political censorship within Australia on social media platforms owned by companies based in authoritarian states with very different values and approaches to managing the online information system? This is not a theoretical concern. There are many platforms like this that already have millions of users in Australia. Should we be concerned about the potential for data collection from these platforms, not just for intelligence collection, but potentially for coercion and intimidation of Australians, or even to inform foreign influence campaigns? It's important that the Australian government is having an open and credible conversation with the Australian public about the new risks that we face. In this context, we need to start getting serious about the way we talk about the integrity of our democratic institutions. This need is particularly acute when it comes to cyber attacks on these institutions. Foreign interference through cyber-enabled information operations is now a real and continuous threat for democratic institutions. In recent years, we've seen cyber attacks on the Bundestag, the Taiwan Parliament, the Ukraine Central Election Commission, and our own federal parliament. Attacks on the email and social media accounts of individual politicians and candidates are even more common. Perhaps most famously, the breach and subsequent publication of Democratic National Committee emails during the 2016 US presidential election. Sometimes the motivation for these attacks is espionage, but on other occasions the intent is to leverage the breach to interfere with the democratic process. Maintaining public confidence in the integrity of our democratic institutions in this context is a real challenge. Despite the overwhelming evidence of the 2016 US presidential election attacks, subsequent information operations have led many to view allegations about the activity of, quote, Russian hackers with cynicism. This hasn't been helped by the troubling pattern of political figures publicly attributing embarrassing social media activity, favouriting pornographic tweets or favouriting tweets critical of their political leaders, to hackers, and then failing to cooperate with law enforcement investigations into these incidents. The recent escapades of the one tweet hacker is a case in point. Australian politicians have recently been tormented by a hacker with the unusual MO of breaching their Twitter accounts and then using this extraordinary access to merely favourite a single embarrassing tweet. Scott Morrison, Christopher Pyne, Greg Hunt, and Joe Hockey have all been recent victims of the one tweet hacker. Yet after their initial public claims, only Greg Hunt followed through with a formal referral to the AFP. They found no evidence that Mr. Hunt's account had been hacked. Cyber-enabled disinformation campaigns rely on misdirection and deniability. They thrive on public cynicism and mistrust. Given that, it's crucial that the public can have confidence in what they are told about cyber attacks on our democratic institutions. We need to set a much higher bar in the way we talk about these cyber attacks. It's why I recently wrote to the Speaker of the House of Representatives about comments made by Christopher Pyne about the extent of the attacks on the Parliament House IT systems in 2018. It's also why I believe that Australia's policy on the attribution of cyber attacks should explicitly treat attacks on our democratic institutions as special and distinct. Australia's policy on the attribution of cyber attacks is currently a classified document owned by DFAT and the Department of Home Affairs. I don't know what it says, and nor does the Australian public. So it's hard to know what the government's current approach to attribution is. The Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton, has variously said in interviews that the Australian government will attribute cyber attacks, or it has the right to, where it is in the national interest. In practice, sometimes the government does make formal on-the-record attribution statements. Sometimes the government makes on-the-record statements that obliquely refer to the historical source of the tools used in the attack without making a formal attribution against the nation. Most commonly, though, attribution is seemingly made through off-the-record comments to the media from intelligence or government sources. It's hard to know what to make of these quasi-attributions from the outside. Are they really the formal views of the government, just of individuals, of rogue employees? The ambiguity is the point. We don't know how the government decides whether to make attributions or quasi-attributions, who was involved, what considerations do they weigh up, even who the key audience is for an attribution statement. We often focus on the impact of attribution statements on perpetrators in the international community, on other nations, on the impact that they have in deterring future bad behaviour and in reinforcing norms of international law. And there are certainly some people who study this who think that more direct formal attribution should be made in order to more clearly indicate to other countries where Australia considers the line to be. But the most important audience the government needs to speak to after an attack on our democratic institutions is the Australian public. We need to establish a norm that governments will be upfront with the Australian public about attacks on our democratic institutions. There needs to be a presumption that when cyber attacks occur on our democratic institutions, the Australian government will, where possible, attribute responsibility for these attacks. Given the stakes for our democracy, we cannot allow any room for cynicism or mistrust from the Australian public about attacks of this kind. Finally, we need to get serious about renewing our democracy more broadly. I was proud when the Labor leader, Anthony Albanese, spoke about the need to renew our democracy in his third vision statement in December last year. He described practical steps that we need to take to restore public trust and ensure our democracy can deliver for the Australian public. A National Integrity Commission, the urgent need for which has been compellingly reiterated by the recent sports rort scandal. Political donation and disclosure reform, including caps on election spending. Defending a free press and the right to protest. Backing the Your Right to Know campaign and making it clear that journalists should not be raided just for doing their job. Properly funding our public broadcaster, one of the few institutions in our democracy that has been able to retain high levels of public trust during this period of change. There's an appalling contrast between how hard ABC staff have worked this summer to accurately cover the fires and rebut misinformation and to provide communities with vital emergency broadcasts and the government's funding cuts and their ongoing campaign of denigration against our public broadcaster. And finally, in the context of technological and media trends that are dividing us, we need to think about national projects that bring us together in a sense of common purpose. Projects that give us the opportunity to deepen the inclusiveness of the Australian national identity, like the Indigenous Voice to Parliament and an Australian Republic. We shouldn't shy away from these democratic reforms because some of them are currently politically contentious. As Harvard historian Jill Lepore recently wrote, it's a paradox of democracy that the best way to defend it is to attack it, to ask more of it by way of criticism, protest and dissent. In this way, the great enemy in the fight to defend our democracy isn't foreign hackers, and it's not social media platforms. It's cynicism. It's the idea that we can't expect any better of our democracy. And that's a battle we must win for ourselves. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Tim. Take a seat. Now, if I've got this right, I think you said at the beginning of your remarks that you were in grade two when the Berlin Wall came down.
That's right.
That makes me quite a bit older than you. And that gives me, I feel like, a little bit more elbow room to ask you direct questions within the bounds of civility and, you know, the obligations of a host.
Is this another Gen Y cliche?
What I wanted to begin with, and in a moment I'm going to open it up to everybody, so please have your questions ready. I won't impose myself too much on the proceedings. But where I wanted to begin was just to ask you whether the kind of scepticism that you showed, I think, in your remarks about the way the internet has developed and the implications it's had for authoritarian countries and for democracies. So you pointed to Clinton's comments around the year 2000, I think it was, about, you know, the effect. In fact, I think it was earlier than that, when China acceded to the WTO. I think there was a lot of optimism about how the internet and free trade was going to open up China politically as well as economically. And then maybe we reached the peak of techno-optimism around 2011, when it was thought really that the Arab Spring, you know, that Twitter and Facebook were going to level all these autocracies and dictatorships around the Middle East. And of course, since then, things have gone radically in the opposite direction. And I think your remarks kind of embody the techno-pessimism that is commonplace at the moment. But what I want to challenge you on is whether that ought to be the last word on the subject. After all, the internet's only 30 years old. Facebook and Twitter are less than 20 years old. We wouldn't be pronouncing the final word, or we wouldn't have been pronouncing the final word on the printing press, for instance, after 17 years. If we had, we would have been radically wrong. So this is a huge force. We're only beginning to understand what it means for the entire world, the world economy, and for politics around the world. Convince me that, and convince everyone here that this pessimism that you feel about the internet is not maybe just a passing phase.
I don't think I can take up that mission, because I can't try to make the final word on technological development. The pessimism that you heard in this speech was the pessimism of a convert, frankly, the zeal of a convert. I was one of those tech optimists. I thought that technology would be, you know, the empowering and agency driving force that we thought it would be in the 1990s. Indeed, I did my dissertation at university on that. But you know, the wheel does constantly turn. I think we do need to wait and see how these trends evolve. Nobody was predicting 20 years ago that we would see the kind of internet balkanization that we are seeing at the moment. You know, we've had 20 years of technological standards converging, not just in international trade agreements, but between manufacturers and between standard-setting bodies in the technology sector. You know, interoperability has been growing constantly. It's only very recently that has changed. And by very recently, I'm talking, you know, 5 years, maybe 5 to 10 years. So this is certainly a new trend. But it's a worrying trend. And I think it's a particularly worrying trend for Australia, because if the internet is cleaving, if it is balkanising and separating, what island are we going to be left on in this technology balkanisation? You know, is it the island of our security interests? Is it the island of our economic interests? And this is an issue that has pretty significant consequences for Australia, I think.
I also wanted to ask you to dig a little bit deeper on this theme about the decline of trust in public institutions that you talked about. It's really a very simple question. I mean, the evidence you presented seems to me impossible to refute. It's clear that there is a decline in trust in politics, in media, etc. But why? Why has that happened?
Look, it's difficult to be precise, but we can rule a few things out. There aren't domestic causes for this. This is a trend we see in all democratic nations around the world, frankly. So it's not something about Australia. I mean, you know, the leadership changes we've seen here have not been fun, and been even less fun from the inside, I give you a tip. But they can't have caused this decline in trust, because we see it everywhere. The other interesting thing is we see it in basically every institution in our in our society, and not just democratic institutions. You know, we see it in the churches. You know, maybe there is good reason for that. Basically, the only institution in Australia that hasn't seen this decline in trust is the Defence Force. So, I mean, I would sort of go through a process of ruling things out and think that, well, the Defence Force, they're pretty good at delivering. You know, they haven't let people down recently. Like, maybe that's something to do with it. But I haven't seen compelling arguments about what is actually driving this. But what I do know is we need to get into the fight. We need to start investing in these institutions again. We need to start taking them seriously. Like, my generation didn't grow up thinking about democracy, making the argument for it, investing in it, thinking about the idea of citizenship and sacrifice for a greater good. It's just, we were so complacent. You know, we thought it was managerialism from here on out, not realising that we had to really invest in the foundations of our democracy.
Certainly in other democracies, the US and around Europe and the UK, there are obvious causes for disaffection. But in Australia, we've entered, what is it, our 28th consecutive year of economic growth? I mean, our political class has delivered fairly well, right?
It is true to say that unlike, say, the United States or the United Kingdom, we have delivered growth across all income deciles, for example, though it is still unequal growth. And the wealth disparities in particular are very significant. But, you know, we have utterly failed to deal with the signal issue of our time, which is climate change. So I don't think we can sort of pat ourselves on the back too much about how effective we have been at delivering. Yes, we haven't been in a recession since I was in grade 3, 4. But there's more to government than just keeping the economy afloat.
Yeah. Well, let me open it up to all of you now. And I'll begin over there. There's a microphone that's going to rove around.
Dr. Helena Zaborcova, I've got a PhD in government international relations, but my current work has diverted me from international security. Tim, thank you very much for your sharp and alarming insight into the health of Australian democracy and health of democracy as such in the light of cybersecurity. Now, when you were when I was listening to your insights, I had an image of government cybersecurity experts as some sort of surgeons who cut specific information from society, and in this way they take functions to shape ideology of any specific country. Since it's a very important and key role in when it comes to any particular country to shape ideology, and it also related to the issue of regaining public trust, should we have some sort of transparent cybersecurity committee whose views would be open to the public, and in this way, the population would be able to determine whether they trust these people and these particular representatives, and then in this way trust the policy that shapes our ideology in a way. Thank you.
I suppose, sort of taking that in the big picture, I am a believer in institutional innovation, in trying new things with institutions in our democracy. And I say that because if you ask a sociologist, well, what is an institution? I say, well, it's a function of societal norms and expectations and technologies. You look at the institutions of Australian democracy, they really haven't changed substantially since the early 20th century, late 19th century. There's been a bit of technological change since then. There are more things that we could do through these institutions. The story I tell to sort of give an indication of how outdated these institutions are is, you know, in Parliament we still have first, second, third readings of bills, of legislation. Like, you know why we structure our Parliament in that way and have first, second and third readings of bills. Because when the institution of Parliament was invented, parliamentarians were illiterate. Now, we still have that function. So I think that a spring clean of democratic institutions in light of the new capabilities that technology enables is just sort of beyond time. I think government having a more transparent conversation with the Australian public about these issues would also be useful. I think the approach that Mike Burgess is taking at ASIO, similar to the approach he's taken at ASD in bringing the public in to the conversation about what his security agency is doing, is very valuable in this context. I think we need new institutional innovation. I'm not sure if a specific cybersecurity department or committee is what we're looking for, but I think the spirit of trying new things is important.
Hi. I hope you don't take this as a criticism of you, but you have talked about democratic reform and stuff, but you've come from a party that is very non-democratic internally. Pre-selection of members is run behind closed doors. factional contests, branch stacking. The question I want to ask is, do you see a way forward for democratisation of our parties whilst avoiding the sort of negative outcomes that other countries that have done this have gotten? For example, UK Labour democratised, but then only the most radical members of society joined the party, and we got a UK Labour leader who was absolutely not representative of the public, and I think that showed in the election results. So do you see any way forward for democratisation of political parties in Australia?
You needn't worry about offending me with a critique of the Labour Party. Like, I have heard people criticise the Labour Party before. I'm comfortable with that. Look, I'd say that the Labour Party as an institution is one of extraordinary innovation. I mean, when we started electing the Labour movement to run countries, that was literally an earth-shaking reform around the world. It was discussed around the world. Since then, the institutional forms of the party has changed radically, and particularly in recent times. You know, the leadership model for the election of the federal leader of the Labour Party, a 50-50 membership ballot and caucus ballot, is an institutional innovation that I think works, that's got the balance right. You know, party reform is always about trade-offs. You know, you can push things one way, but there'll be consequences over here, and we see that very clearly in the UK Labour Party. But this 50-50 membership caucus ballot for the leadership of the Labour Party, I think, is really reflective of the way that the Labour Party does institutional innovation. It gets that balance right. It's like a deal. It's a trade-off. It's egalitarian. The other thing I'd point to is we're seeing institutional innovation in the forums of the party. Our national conference has always been open to the public to watch. Sometimes that is very uncomfortable. It can be embarrassing to see these issues, you know, thrashed out on the floor of the conference. But I think a really interesting innovation that we've seen is the policy action caucuses that have occurred. So the Labor Environment Action Network has organised throughout the country. You know, it turns up to my branch meetings all the time. It puts a particular opinion, it puts a particular policy position, and it organises in favour of that within the party. And I think that's been an overwhelmingly positive thing. They've achieved substantial change in the party, not everything that they want, but, you know, that's what representative government is about. And in its wake, we've seen a whole number of groups mirroring that. So there's a Labour for Aid group, there's a Labour for Housing group, and these are all really welcome, I think, institutional innovations within the party. Am I saying that the Labour Party is perfect? No. I don't think anyone has ever claimed that. Indeed, if you're a historian of the party, one of my favourite quotes was a quote from someone wringing their hands at despair at the fact that Labour had abandoned its ideological mission and was just a vote-collecting body now, and that was in the 1900s.
I've got a follow-up, actually, Tim, because about democratisation. I noticed among the list of things that the Labour Party had proposed to restore trust in institutions, that where you ended your speech, you talked about protecting protest rights, a National Integrity Commission, funding of the ABC, projects that bring Australians together. It struck me that one possible thing that was missing is the idea of actually returning political power to Australians. It's felt to me for a long time that you know, power has become very much more centralised, and one way to restore trust in our democracy would actually be to trust the public more with the authority to do things. There are mechanisms available. So yeah, I just want to be thoughts.
Are we talking devolution here, direct democracy? I mean, there are lots of sort of ways.
Direct democracy or citizen juries is one that I particularly like.
I mean, I support institutional innovations, particularly to buttress the institutions we have at the moment. Citizen juries, like, I'm a big fan of. That not everyone in Australian politics is a big fan of them, but I think that they could usefully be used as a buttress for legitimacy. Like, if I was a minister and I had a tricky policy challenge, considering a citizen jury that I could make a case to and sort of, you know, get a thumbs-up verdict from, or thumbs-down, you know, chance it, like, as a way of buttressing legitimacy for a decision, would be something I'd be interested in. Devolution's a little bit more difficult in Australia because of federation, and I think most Australians probably feel like we've got enough layers of government. But yeah, look, I mean, my general position on these issues is that we need to be innovating, we need to be trying new things, so I need to be recapturing that spirit of democratic innovation that we had in Australia before the First World War.
Yeah. Alan Gidgell.
Thanks very much, Tim. It was so good to hear one of our
parliamentarians talking in this reflective way about one of the big issues. I wonder if you've done any thinking at all about the implications of these issues for the international system itself. Are there parallels in your mind with what we saw in the arms control area from the sort of creation of the atomic bomb onwards? So is there capacity for the international system to reach agreements on how these things are handled? Or is the technology and the politics just so far beyond it that it's not worth trying, and that deterrence and the capacity to strike back at someone else's electricity system if they strike at yours is the only thing open to us?
It's a typically excellent question. I mean, there are significant bodies of literature in academia drawing that analogy between arms control and cyber weapons today. And there are many similarities, frankly, and potentially similar policy responses. A lot of the issues with cyber weapons are it's difficult to signal what your capability is and what your intent is. There's a lot of sort of forward defense of people setting up cyber weapons, of sort of planting things on electricity networks and things like that. And that can be interpreted in multiple ways by nations who are subjected to that. Where that sort of causes fallow line is, it's a tricky one, and it's one that needs a lot of norms development around it. I would say, though, that there is a lot of existing international law that can be well applied to this question. I look at the NotPetya malware attacks that the Russian government undertook against Ukraine. They used a piece of retail accountancy software to deliver this malware into the Ukrainian domestic community. It brought down the post office, it brought down the electricity grid, it brought down many significant institutions in Ukraine, and then it got out of hand and started running around the world, and it brought down Maersk, the biggest shipping and logistics company in the world. I think looking at international law and norms around not using weapons on domestic populations, these are dangerous things. You start shutting down electricity grids, you start shutting down logistics networks, people will die. So I think existing international norms are a good place to start there.
I'm inspired by what you're talking about and really encouraged to ask you a really key question. When will Australia become a republic?
Oh, I hope before I die.
We'll get the next question. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Tim, for a very thought-provoking presentation. Just two thoughts to offer in or questions. The first is, it strikes me that we hear a lot about decline in trust, and the other side of that coin is actually the question of trustworthiness. And part of the decline of trust has been around institutions demonstrating themselves not to be worthy of trust. So I'm just wondering if that's a helpful thought to bring into the mix. And the other is in relation to reform. I'm just not sure that spring cleaning and buttressing is actually going to be enough, and I'm wondering whether we need to do even deeper thinking about the system itself standing from outside, for example, whether the partisan system is one that's going to work anymore.
So on trust and trustworthiness, yes, absolutely, institutions need to earn trust. And some of the declines in trust that we see in our society are clearly a result of breaches. So, the Catholic Church is the classic example there. However, the thing that really troubles me is the collapse in trust of institutions that have done nothing wrong. Why anyone would have a lack of trust in the Bureau of Meteorology, I just do not know. Upanza, they are scientific experts. And the number of people that believe they are stooges of the international telco cartel and are lying about the health effects of 5G is really concerning. The chief medical officer's views on vaccination, there's something more going on than just people not earning trust. In terms of Republican big picture reforms, so when I look at that technology, you know, I was talking about transaction costs before with the internet, right? So the internet makes it a lot easier to find people with similar interests to yours and niche ones, right? The example I give of this is, imagine that I am someone that really loves My Little Ponies. I'm a man who likes My Little Ponies. This is a thing. They're called bronies. It's a real community. 20 years ago, if I wanted to start a brony club, how would I do that? Right? So I'd probably have to go and book a community hall for the first meeting of the Tim Watts Brony Theme Club. Then I would have to go down to Officework and print dozens of flyers and I'd paste up those flyers around town saying, come and meet at this particular spot. Like, I might do a letterbox drop of it. I might loiter around toy shops waiting for other men. The point is there are costs to doing it, and transaction costs of finding other people with shared interests. You know, today, you just hop on Facebook or Reddit, you start a subreddit, you start a Facebook group, and away you go. And, you know, a lot of the times that's a positive thing. I mean, we see all the Facebook groups for local communities. So every suburb in my electorate has a Facebook group. There are Facebook groups supporting people managing diseases, like parenting groups for ADHD or for autism. And, you know, these are good things. The thing that troubles me about it, though, is that all of the dynamics in our society are pushing us into these smaller groups. They're tearing us apart, and the shared space in our society has been lost. And that's why I use those statistics about television news and newspapers, because there are only a handful of those. You know, you think about the reform task facing the Hawke Keating government. You know, there's, what, half a dozen newspapers, four TV channels. Paul Keating could walk down the corridors of Parliament House and speak to the editor of every one of them and reach 6 in 10 Australians that night or the next day. You just can't do that anymore. You know, we're all sort of fragmented and splintered and in our own segments. And that's why the things that bring us together, you know, Indigenous Voice to Parliament, Republic, are things that really interest me. I think we need to proactively invest in things that bring us together. The thing that I've sort of found most inspiration from in recent years was Noel Pearson in the Loita O'Donoghue oration. He talked about Indigenous constitutional recognition, and he talked about the need to bring together the three stories of Australia. So our tens of thousands of years of Indigenous heritage, our Westminster institutions, and our multicultural migration. You can't tell the story of Australia without those three stories. But what are we doing to bring them together? What's the shared space in our society? So I think when we're looking at these questions of democratic reform, we need to be focusing on the things we have in common and investing in them and strengthening them.
And by the way, that's where Tim ended there, is the theme of your book, The Golden Generation.
Golden Country.
Golden Country, excuse me.
Available in all good bookstores, yes. And on the internet, but buy from your local bookstore.
We've got time for one more. Let's take this lady here.
I just wanted to come back to the topic of the health of our democracy, the need to renew democracy. Obviously, institutions and government have a role to play. The health of institutions is important for a functioning democracy. But a democracy, by its very definition, depends on the public, because in a democracy, it is the citizen's responsibility to hold institutions to account. And it is not a functioning democracy if people aren't politically engaged, are not fully informed and curious and interested in what's going on in the political arena or what's happening in the wide world. Then I see a disconnect between, let's say, the public and the government and the leaders. I simply make the observation that I lived overseas as an Australian. I lived overseas for nearly 2 decades, 20 years, and came back to Australia about 10 years ago. So, in fact, I left Australia sort of early 90s. One of my observations, one of the first things I noticed when I came back to Australia from the UK and Europe, I must point out that was where I was living, is in comparison to where I've been living in the world, a lack of political engagement at a citizen level and a lack of awareness of what was happening in the rest of the world generally, a lack of knowledge of what was happening on the other side of the world, maybe not just in conflict areas, but in other parts of the world. Now, obviously, Australia's had an immense period of economic growth, prosperity, and it's not to be diminished in any way. That's a very
positive thing about Australia, but I am wondering about the fallout for that, for complacency, for maybe a level of apathy about directly engaging in political issues, maybe, you know, voicing out demands to the government to be accountable, to be more democratic.
I'm delighted that you asked that question, because democracy is about citizenship. It's about participation. I would say that, in my impression, Australians are extremely engaged in politics, but it's small p politics. They're not engaged in our representative democracy. Like, I see incredible political activism around issues. A lot of this is online, sort of single issue campaigning. You know, Parliament ought to do something about this, ought to do something about that. And I very often say to these campaigners, like, if you want to do something about it, join a political party. You know, like, get involved in that part of it. That was part of what I was trying to get to in the speech, talking about we need a new generation of sort of JFK, Reagan, to make the case for democracy, where, you know, we make the case that as citizens we all share responsibility for the health of this democracy, and, you know, it's something that we all rely on each other to do. And particularly with this misinformation, disinformation, like, there ought to be a social sanction on sharing crap on the internet. Like, people ought to feel ashamed about doing that. And that sanction ought to be enforced against them by other people in our society. And that's something that can only happen if we have a view of citizenship, and that we are a part of a democracy, that we are part of something bigger than ourselves.
Well, Tim, thank you. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for all being here this evening. The Lowy Institute runs, you know, lots of events in around the country, but in Canberra all the time, and we're always grateful that you come. Please keep an eye on the website for upcoming events. But for now, can I ask you just to put your hands together for Tim Watts?